Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Good evening. My name is Lowell, and I'm an alcoholic. Good to be here tonight on Saturday Night Sober. This is not where I once would have been. I want to thank everybody who does the work to put this thing together. Thank my host Mark down here. He's doing a lot of driving, getting me back and forth to the hotel and airport and all of that. So thanks to everybody that does the work. It's really a privilege and honor to be here. I was here one time. I think Daryl told me it was about 6 years ago. So it's good to be back. I love this part of the country. My sobriety date is March the 7th, 1990, and for much of the story tonight, I'll be talking about the last 3 days of my drinking career, March 7th, 8th, and 9th, and those days are intense for me every year as they roll around, and it's been a while since that first year, but I noticed that the intensity remains, and on any of those days, they're just like the Kennedy assassination. I can look at my watch on any of those 3 days, and I know what was taking place at that particular time on that particular day. And I hope I never forget that. I hope I never relive it. I'm supposed to talk in a general way what we were like, what happened, what we're like now. I used to say what it was like, and I don't think it's a big deal, really. I know some people do, but I hear a lot of speakers do that. And I got a real cryptic email several years back from a guy who identified himself as an old-timer in Georgia. And he said, I was listening to one of your CDs with some newcomers here, and you're misquoting the big book. And I thought, you know, I don't quote the big book to begin with. I know there are speakers that can come up here and do that. I don't have that gift. They'll come up here and I'll give you a page number and a paragraph location, and they'll quote that. And I'm not able to do that. Every time they do it, I know, yeah, I've read that. I know I can't tell you exactly where it is, but I'm certainly familiar with it. Although once in a while, I'll throw out something like, if you look at the second paragraph on page 132, I have no idea what's there. I know you just go look. But I didn't know what he was talking about. And he said, you're saying what it was like. And I thought, oh, really? Is that worth an email? But I put my A face on and I said, okay, excuse me. I'm really sorry. I'll try to do better. And apparently that didn't, he took it about the way you guys did. It didn't have that real ring of sincerity to it. And so I get another email, and he says, you know, it's really important. He said, if some of us old-timers were sitting on the front row and you started like that, we might just get up and walk out, thinking that if you're going to start by misquoting the big book, then the rest of the message can't be that good. And by that time, I took my A face off at that point. That kind of tweaked my competitive spirit. And so I said, you know, if that happened, I don't think I'd burst into tears at the podium. I probably wouldn't rush out to get a drink. But I said, as long as this seems to keep bouncing back and forth between us, just let me remind you that when we read How It Works, it doesn't say, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly memorized the book. I didn't get any more emails, but you know, AA has its own way of working. And about 3 years later, I went down there to the Flint River Roundup and he was my host. But it certainly, he certainly made his point. I never said what it was like. So I mixed the order up a little bit, and I'm going to start by telling you what happened, because it was a huge event from a national media standpoint. And on the morning of March the 8th, an event occurred that had never reached the public's attention, and that is that an airline crew of three pilots were arrested for having flown from Fargo Airport to the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport, and I was the captain of that flight crew. Now, I've seen that happen a whole bunch of times since then, but those things hardly even make the news nowadays. Some guy will get stopped going through TSA, and you'll see or hear about it one afternoon, and it's not there on day two. But I can assure you that I was the first pilot to whom this had happened. And the media, absolutely, and this was an incredibly sensational story, and it stayed on the media for weeks into months, and I didn't think it was ever, ever, ever going to go away. I was, the other thing I want to issue, and I'll issue several caveats as I go through this, and that is that, you know, most of the time people come up here and talk, and we never know what they did for a living. By the time they leave the podium, we don't know what they did for a living, and rightfully so, because we're up here to tell a story of recovery, not talk about what we did as a job, career, profession, or whatever. And the only reason I talk about it is because it was the thing that drove the story. That if I had been a doctor, an attorney, a plumber, electrician, or anything else, none of this would have occurred. There would have been no interest in it, and I certainly wouldn't have set myself up for a federal felony conviction. So it's in the context of that and that alone that I talk about it. I don't believe we have any prestige or status in this fellowship. I'm a hardcore believer in that. I've been places and I've seen a few who seem to think otherwise, but I absolutely don't. I believe that the only thing that we come here for and our common denominator, the thing that makes all of us equal, whether you just came out from underneath a bridge or whether you own the finest home in this area, drive the nicest car, the one thing that keeps us together is a thing called a search for sobriety. And when we come here for that and that alone, and that's the strength and fiber of this fellowship. And until or unless I get an email saying that we just broke ground on the A Hall of Fame, I'm gonna continue to think that. And I'm not an airline pilot who is an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic who got to be an airline pilot, and I'll talk a little bit about that. I was detained for 12 hours that day, and it was a very surreal experience. I could not believe this was happening to me. This wasn't who I was. It wasn't what I had been. It wasn't supposed to end this way, but it did. And then I had these out-of-body experiences where I thought I was watching this happen to someone else, that it's not possible that this could be happening to me. And then things would shift. I'd look around and I'd think, is this happening to me? And I would almost get physically ill. Northwest Airlines at that time was the only major carrier that didn't have a program for alcoholic pilots. And so occasionally, periodically, I would see a pilot get in difficulty on a layover. And if that occurred and if it got back to the company, there was one outcome only. They were terminated immediately, and that story and that word swept through the ranks of the pilots and flight attendants like wildfire. And I had a million tumbling thoughts that morning, that day, and I thought, that's how I leave here. My name goes on that hall of shame, because I remembered a lot of the names and the locales and the details as best they've been related, and the idea that this was the way I was going to leave just devastated me. From the moment I walked off the airplane and I saw two airport policemen and airline officials and FAA people, the instant, overwhelming, all-consuming, totally penetrating feeling I had was one of shame. Shame and disgrace and dishonor. I used to spend some time trying to describe that because I thought it was important. And the big book says it better than I'll ever be able to say when it talks about pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I don't think it can be said any better than that. And that was immediately my reaction. Later, and that got exponentially worse as the days ahead unfolded and this thing began to escalate a lot farther than I knew it was going to go. Later, I thought about that, and I thought the reason that I was so devastated was because I was the guy in my family, as I had raised three children who were grown and gone, who was the constant standard bearer for things like duty, honor, country, character, honesty, and integrity. And the personal example that I had just set made all of that seem so hollow and meaningless and I had a hard time with that. We were detained for 12 hours that day. We went to two different facilities and gave blood. And it was at the second facility that a reporter saw two uniformed cops and three uniformed pilots and thought there might be a story there, and that's how it broke to the public. Now, I had no earthly idea that was about to occur. The mere fact that Northwest Airlines was going to hear about this and all my pilot friends, peers, and buddies and flight attendants, the mere fact that was ahead for me was almost more than I can handle. I had no idea this thing was going to go all over the U.S., Canada, Asia, and Europe. So we were finally released that day, and I got back to a commuter apartment I had. I had forgotten, due to the trauma and everything that was occurring, that I was supposed to be home that evening. And I called home, and Barbara, my wife, had waited at the Atlanta airport for 4 hours, and I had not shown up. And when I called, I heard my voice on the answering machine, and all I could do was just get out a very whispered, defeated message that there had been a disaster. I thought I'd lost my job. I'd be home the first flight in the morning. She didn't call me back. And later, I looked at that, and I thought, what a gift that was. I was so sick that I just didn't want to talk about this. I was absolutely heartsick over this. And I got home the next morning, a very early flight, made my way through the airport, didn't want anybody to stop me. I knew everybody out there, the Northwest folks. Didn't want anybody to say hi, stop me in any way. And I exited very quickly and saw Barbara parked by the curb over to the right. Now, I've never told the story, but haven't said that I felt like I had to climb over the curb to get in the car with her. And she and I had been married a long time, and I could not look at my wife. I could not turn and look at her as I got in the car. And all I could say was, honey, I'm so sorry. She got a very soft South Texas voice, and she pulled away from the curb, and she said, who better than I might possibly understand how you feel right now? We drove home in silence. Again, another gift, because later I thought, what wife, having learned that her husband had just trashed a 22-year golden career as an airline captain, would not have said, you've seen this before. You knew the Northwest policy. Why did you stay and drink? Why didn't you go back to your hotel room? She had a right to every one of those questions, and I had an answer for none of them. So we drove home in silence. She went to work. I went in the house, and I couldn't stay still. I did not want to be in my skin. And shortly thereafter, I picked the phone up, and I called the only person that I knew to call, who will get into this story here in a little while. But he was a PhD family therapist. And I said to him, there's been a disaster. I need to declare an emergency. I need to see you right away. He said, come straight in. I'll clear the calendar. And I drove over there. And I can still see that office as if it happened 5 minutes ago. I can see him. And the good thing about what had happened was that this was the coup de grace. This was it for me. There was no more fight, no more resistance, no more playing with the truth, no more minimizing. So I went in and I just told him straight out what had happened. And he pulled back in some shock and stunned surprise. And he said, God, Lyle, he said, this is horrible. He said, this is absolutely horrible. He said, he looked at me. He started around the desk. This is now Friday, March the 9th. And I was going to hear two comments that day that I could not even begin to process. I heard the first one now. He started around the desk and he stopped and he turned and he looked at me. And he said, but maybe this is what had to happen. I had no idea why he would say that to me. I had no idea what brought that up, what made it come out, and I didn't respond. He came back a few minutes later. He said, I want you to go see another doctor. He said, I was on staff with him a number of years ago. He said, he's a very well-known doctor here in Atlanta. He's a psychiatrist. He's a recovering alcoholic and cocaine addict. And he's certified in addiction medicine, which I had never, ever heard of. He said he wants to see you at 6 o'clock tonight. This is a Friday night. And I knew that that conveyed a certain sense of urgency. I picked up on that. Later, the doctor told me, he said, based on your appearance, he said, I was so afraid you were a suicide. And it was imperative to get you over to see that man right away. So Barbara and I followed a long, detailed set of instructions to this man's office, 6 o'clock on Friday night. And I went in and had a meeting with him. Barbara stayed in the waiting area. It was already starting to get dark in Minneapolis. And I have no recall of that meeting. It's just like an alcoholic blackout, of which I have had many. And I hadn't had anything to eat or drink for 2 whole days. But I have no recall of that meeting, except that I was there and I gave him an honest answer to every question he posed to me. I just told him that whatever the truth was as best I could. At some point he looked at me and said, "Lyle, you're an alcoholic. You need to get into treatment tonight." And I had no reaction to that. And that was significant because I've hated alcoholics all my entire life. I have 2 parents who died from this disease. I saw what happened in the family. I've seen alcoholics in the doorways and the alleyways when I flew around the country. I saw them in my Native American community when I grew up. They were always life's losers, non-hackers, the people on the bottom. And I've hated them and had nothing but disgust and repugnant feelings toward them. And he's telling me that I'm an alcoholic and nothing registers in here as far as any kind of a rebelling nature is concerned. And I look back and I think in the 24 hours since the arrest, in a way I'll never understand, all those dots got connected way down deep. And I knew, already knew, that I was that one thing that I said I would never, ever, ever be. And I was an alcoholic. And I looked at him, I said, "I don't have any problem going into treatment. I thought you'd probably tell me that. But I said, I just got home today. I said, I'd like to go home. Please let me go home and let Barbara just hold on to me and let my mind uncoil and let me just absorb what's happened to me and I'll go into treatment." He said, "You need to go there tonight." And I paused and took a breath. I said, "Okay." And so we left. We drove back across Atlanta. And I went into the treatment center with the clothes on my back. And as we made the final turn to this treatment center, the headlights hit a sign that was right there on the corner, and I stopped. The sign was very close by. It said Anchor Hospital, a hospital for alcoholism and other chemical dependencies. And I sat and I looked at that sign. And like most of the things that we do that involve writing and putting things in front of us, the reality was there. And I thought, looking for some water, but I don't see any, but excuse me. Is there some there? Oh yeah, there's 2 bottles. If I drink both of these, we'll have to take a break. Thank you. It's flavored water. Flavored water. That's pretty first class. I looked at that sign and the reality hit. And I thought, my God Almighty, my life ends tonight in a treatment center for alcoholics. What happened? What has happened to me? And I sat there and I had just a little mini flashback of all the past stuff that I had managed to achieve and accomplish, most of it against the odds. These were my trophy moments. These were things that were really big in my life that I was so proud of. And it was like a giant eraser took them all away. I wasn't even sure that they'd ever existed. And I sat there completely devoid of any sense of value as a human being, no self-worth. Some years later, I read a paragraph, summarizing paragraph from one of the doctors at the end of a lengthy report about me. And he said, given the history and background of this man, it was unlikely to believe he would ever be a productive member of society. And I kind of flinched at that. I thought, man, that is really dismal. And then I thought, well, I was the one that gave him all the information, so. We started down the hill into the treatment center. And for the first time that day, this is somewhere around 8 o'clock at night. For the first time that day, it occurred to me, this is my 27th wedding anniversary. And I said in a very defeated way, hell of a way to spend an anniversary, huh? I then heard the second comment that I could not mentally process. Very softly, Barbara said, might be the best one we ever had. And I thought, who could think that? I didn't respond. It was clear to me, I knew unequivocally that my life was gone. This was so far past the point of no return. It was gone. I will never come back from this. It's not possible. It's shattered, it's broken, it's destroyed. Who could think that at a moment like this? And we headed on down the hill into the treatment center. Now, I usually stop here and kind of try to lighten things up a little bit and tell you that I had an anniversary about 7 years ago. And unexpectedly, up the long driveway where we live, came one of my sponsees. Surprised me. It's gorgeous Georgia morning, 9 o'clock, blue skies, nice temperature, beautiful day. I said, what are you doing here? He said, I've heard your story. I know it's March the 9th. I know it's your anniversary. So I said, well, come on inside. So we went in. Barbara had some coffee going, and conversation is light and lively and cheerful. And he says, all of a sudden, he says, well, he said, what's the secret to having stayed married so long? And I didn't get a chance to respond. Barbara said, mostly due to the fact that I could never stand to admit I made a mistake. So for the newcomers here, you'll hear this is an ego-deflating program, but spouses and significant others take that real seriously. And it's kind of funny because about a year ago, I was speaking at Whitworth Women's Prison in South Georgia. It's about a 4 or 5 hour drive from where I am. And I've been there a couple of times, but a women's prison is a really unique audience. They don't look like you gals look. And there's about 40 of them in the room, and I'm talking, and one of them blurts out, you're hot. And that just kind of stops me in my tracks. I've never had that happen before. And I'm trying to kind of get my wheels back under me, and about 3 or 4 more of them yell out, yeah, you're hot. So when I get home, it's way past midnight. It's 1 or 2 in the morning, and Barbara's asleep. The next morning, we're having coffee. So I'm telling her about this. And she looks at me, and she says, they must have been locked up a really long time. You know, I never do this or come here or laugh like this, but what I don't remember, what a gift the laughter is. It was a long time before I could smile, much less laugh. And this laughter that we share here tonight is whole and healthy and healing. And it's a long time coming for many of us. And it's such a gift. And I'm so grateful, you know, that I can now do that because I couldn't do it for a long time. I was born in Wichita, Kansas in September 1938, so I'm just barely north of 77. I don't have any trouble with that, except it's just a big number. It got here awfully fast. And I grew up in a World War II housing project. The other reason I mentioned the age thing is because I do it and just get it out of the way because I know that I'm not the only one that sits out there and tries to figure out how old the speaker is. And usually before the hour is up, they've dropped 2 or 3 names, dates, places, or times, and I've kind of got it all put together. But I've noticed that the AA women speakers are particularly ingenious about it. And I don't know if they go to school for that or if it's a gender thing or what, but they'll say something like, I got out of college, and I'm immediately thinking, oh, 21 or 22. The same year Kennedy was assassinated, I'm going, that's 63 minus 21, 22. Or I had my first child. I was 24. It was 2 years after Neil Armstrong walked on the moon. I'm thinking, well, is that 68 or 69? And so I'm doing the math backwards and forwards, and she leaves and walks off the stage. And I'm going, she's either 43 or 68, and I'm not sure. I don't have no idea. So I just get it out of the way. I grew up in a World War II housing project on the southeast edge of Wichita called Plainview. It's a very economically depressed area. It's not a very pretty place. People without a lot of money, with no money, lived there. We were always scratching and scrambling and trying to catch up. And I think poor is a very subjective term. If I'm on a reservation someplace and I'm looking at some of the housing that I see there, I was never poor by those standards or those terms. And yet, you know, I remember those were some of the happiest times of my entire childhood, also some of the saddest, based on what happened with the alcoholism. But it was a very diverse community. Blacks, whites, Hispanics, and small Native American segment were all intermingled, and we all got along. No school shootings, no gangs, no drugs to speak of in the 50s. And everybody, rarely was there any difficulty or trouble there. And I'm an ethnic mix of several different things, but the two that seem to really show up for the bar time are the Irish and Comanche parts. And, and so, you know, we can't go out and pick our parents, so I am what I am. And I thought that's an okay combination. I love that Irish music and that spirit of drinking songs and rebel songs. And I had the albums and knew the artists and knew the songs. And when I was flying around the country, I knew where those live Irish places were. And I would head for those. I'd change clothes, and 5 minutes later, I'd be out the door, and I'd be there, and I'd stay until the band quit, and I'd sit there singing along to all these songs. Just love that stuff. And then maybe I'd be someplace else, or maybe the mood was different, or something else happened, and I would think the other side would kick in, and I would think, I think tonight I'll just have a few drinks and go out and kill some white people. And so I never knew what was going to happen, but usually my drinking episodes contain an element of excitement one way or the other. I grew up in my native culture. I was a dancer. I knew the songs and the traditions and powwows. I was active in the powwows. I've since gone back to that since I've gotten sober. When I was 14, the alcoholism had really worked its magic inside the family. And my parents got their first divorce, and it really devastated me. It really did. I was fortunate that within my family, with both parents being alcoholic, I never saw any domestic violence. There was no outward fighting, but there was always the alcoholic whatever. I never knew what was getting ready to take place, which one was going to be drunk, both of them going to be drunk. I couldn't take any friends over there. I just never knew what was going to happen. And so the divorce really affected me, and it affected my sister, who was 2 years younger than I, even more. And within the next two or three years, each of those parents had been married and divorced two more times. And I didn't fit in very well with the step-parents and step-siblings. I didn't like them, and I had trouble and conflicts and clashes. And so I would leave, be asked to leave, and go to the other family until something happened there, and then I'd go back over here. So I kind of crisscrossed back and forth going through high school doing that. Ironically, strangely, I don't remember any of those folks. Wouldn't know if they walked in the room tonight. I graduated when I was 17. And most of the people from where I came from didn't go to college. And they married their little 18-year-old sweethearts, and they went to work for the aircraft factories that Wichita is known for, Boeing, Beech, Cessna. There were several more there at the time. I wasn't interested in doing that. I was going to join service, but I didn't know what. About that time, one of my friends came back from the Marine Corps, right out of boot camp. And I tell you what, I was impressed. I was impressed with him, how he looked, how he conducted himself. And we sat in a bar for about 3 or 4 hours, and I just sat there and listened to one story after another, after another, after another, about Marine drill instructors and what they do to their recruits in boot camp. And these were really sadistic, cruel stories. And I'm hanging on every word. And I've just barely turned 18, and it was probably an early sign of how my thinking was going to go for the rest of my life, because I thought, I just can't wait to go do that. And so off I went. So I found a Marine recruiter, and off I went. You know, I hear a lot of stories, and there's usually two common themes, neither one of which is applicable in my story. It's true for the people who come up here, but it's not true for me, and that is I never fit in, never felt like I fit in. That's not true for me. And the other one is, I took that first drink, I was going to chase it for the rest of my life because the magic happened. It's not true for me either. I didn't like the taste of my first drink, didn't like the taste of the last drink. I like the effect, but normal people like the effect as well. But I read some information, I don't know if it's credible, but it seems to be. It said that it's true, but alcoholics like it 5 to 8 times more than normal people do. And I can believe that, but of course we don't know that We don't know that as we're sitting there drinking with all of our friends. Pardon me. So, my drinking picked up over the course. The other caveat I'm going to issue is I'm not going to tell a big long drunkalogue. I don't have time. I'm watching a timer up here. I know how much time he's got. I know how much time I've got. It's another 2 hours and 14 minutes somehow. But I don't have time to go through a big long drunkalogue. And I think it's important for identity purposes, but my drinking was like everybody else's. My story's like everybody else's. I drank too long, too much. I woke up in places I didn't know where I was or how I got there. I got in fights. I lost cars. I had a lot of blackouts, a lot of blank spots in there. I had two DWIs, separated by about 5 years. I was convinced those were just absolutely coincidentally bad luck stuff. I got a good Indian buddy who said, he was telling me one time, he said he was in court for his sixth DWI before he learned that that did not stand for drinking with Indians. I signed on the dotted line and off I went to Marine boot camp and I found out where I belonged. That's where I belonged. Once I got over the culture shock, I snapped into that pretty quickly. I loved it. It was fierce, fierce, fiercely intense. There's no other experience like Marine boot camp. That's not a put down on the other services. It's just a fact. And I went through this 13 weeks of Marine boot camp. And in the 13th week, the final week, the drill instructors called out three names out of about 70 of us. And my name was the second name called. Three names of the top three guys. I was amazed. I was surprised. I had no idea. And I had never achieved or accomplished anything like that, especially under those conditions and circumstances. So I got a PFC stripe. That's one stripe, private first class. You cannot run the Marine Corps as a private first class. But I couldn't take my eyes off of that stripe. Just couldn't take my eyes off that stripe. And, I've got one stripe. My buddy's 67. I'm still private slick sleeves. And so we go to Camp Pendleton, and we're standing guard duty. And I'm inside because I'm acting corporal of the guard. It's raining. My buddies are outside walking with a 9-pound rifle over their shoulder. And I look over in the corner and I see a first lieutenant's uniform. I see the silver bar on that. I remember looking at that and sliding my chair back and thinking, you know what? At the rate I'm going, general can't be that far away. So I'm staying. And stay I did. I love being a Marine. I fit in because I'd experienced that thing that the Marine Corps is known for. I'd never felt it, experienced or seen it before, that camaraderie, that esprit de corps. That band of brothers, that one for all for one. It's an incredibly tightly knit group of people, and I loved it. 4.5 years later, and I'm excelling. Now, I'm drinking all the way through this, but I'm always in a hard-drinking environment, so my drinking becomes a little hard to notice because I'm right in the middle of people who are drinking hard as well. And 4.5 years later, I came walking in, and my commanding officer took me into his office, and he said, there's a new program out called Marine Aviation Cadet. And he said, you're the only guy in the unit who has entry scores that would entitle you to go test for that program if you so desired. Now, I'd always wanted to fly, but that was a fantasy idea. That was never reality-based. Pilots, in my view, did not come from plain view. They didn't come out of an alcoholic home, and they didn't come out of the Native American segment. They came from other parts of Wichita, and they had college, and their families had some prestige and standing. They didn't come from where I came from. But he's telling me I can go test, and I said I'd like to go test. And I went over, and it was an all-day test, and I passed. I came back, and he said, there's some more information you need to know. He said, this is an 18-month program. He said, it's incredibly rapidly paced. It's intense. And statistically, on average, roughly 50% don't make it. They wash out. And the other thing you need to know is you're coming in the back door as an enlisted Marine. The people coming in from the civilian side, of which there will be 98-99%, all have to have 2 years college minimum just to come in the door. And those will be the people you'll be in the program with. And I knew that I stood a good chance of being in that 50% that doesn't make it because I'm starting off with a big educational deficit, really big. But I said, I want to try. Now, I came home to Wichita, and they were having a powwow. I went out and danced. My Kiowa family that I kind of adopted me and spent a lot of time with after the first divorce called for what they call a special, which is an honoring dance. I was going away to Pensacola the next day. And all the way to Pensacola, all I could think of was, there's no way I can come back to this community and tell them I'm back early because I failed, that I flunked out, that I couldn't hack it, I didn't make it. I can't do that because nobody else but me is getting this opportunity. And I was driven with that for all the way through flight training. And at that time, there were four phases to flight training, and every one of those phases, I was always like the number two guy. And I never expected that. I never got cocky, never got confident, never got complacent. I was watching my buddies wash out weekly, sometimes daily, as they come over and with a sea bag over their shoulder and say their goodbye to me. And I don't remember any of them ever meeting my eyes. They always looked down. And I watched them walk away. Their dreams were over. They wanted to fly as badly as I did, but for whatever reason, they weren't going to. And I would never see them again. And I thought, one of these days, that will be me saying my goodbye. But I continued to push ahead. You know, I never go to the podium without thanking my parents for the good stuff they gave me before they died, before they got sober. I mean, before they got alcohol, before the alcohol killed them. Because in that period of time, they taught me an awful lot of good stuff, and it stayed with me. And I owe my parents. I'm not an alcoholic because of my parents. I'm well aware of the genetics and the medical aspects of this disease. But I thank my parents for the good stuff they gave me before the alcohol killed them. I pushed through flight training. The last 6 months of flight training, I left the Florida area. I went to Beeville, Texas for advanced jet training. If I could just finish this last 6 months, I'd be in good shape. Now, let me tell you about my drinking through flight training. Every Friday, and this is way before Vietnam, every Friday and every Saturday, I and my friends are smashingly drunk. I don't remember ever drinking without getting drunk. Why wouldn't I do that? And yet I know that can't be an accurate memory. I'd probably be dead. But Friday and Saturday night, man, I just hit 100 miles an hour with my drinking. We all did. But the big book talks about it. So at a certain point, we can still control our drinking. And I wanted those gold wings more than I wanted to continue to drink. And so on Sunday, I was sobering up, I was studying, I was gearing up, I was getting ready to go for Monday. So I go to Beeville, Texas, and if I can just finish this last 6 months, I got these wings. First night into town, I get drunk with a bunch of my buddies, and we go to the officers' club, and they said, let's go downtown Beeville. There's a place, an old-fashioned drive-in called Cane's. That's where the good-looking girls hang out, and we got an inside track because we're going to be pilots and officers. So I said, okay. I went with them. I was never very aggressive or gutsy with the ladies, but I'd had a lot to drink. And so we go down there, and they immediately go after a carload of girls, and I'm kind of hanging back. And I see the driver's not talking to anybody, but I can't really see her because there's an angle there. But she's not talking to anybody, and I'm back there drinking, and I'm rehearsing some things to say. And it surpassed my normal level of rehearsal and cleverness because I walk up to the car. I'm thinking, God, this stuff is good. She may just take her clothes off sitting there. And I walk up to her, and she turns, and she looks at me, and she is really pretty. And everything I had rehearsed left. I'm vacant. I'm completely vacant. And I'm supposed to say something, so I said to her, you have the most beautiful brown eyes I've ever seen. Except it didn't come out quite like that. It was kind of like, as you usually have that brown, I was just and she looked at me like I just peed on the side of her car. I turned around and I left. I was embarrassed. Thought about that later. I thought, nobody who's that drunk, so drunk that you can't talk, should also be capable of being embarrassed. Those should not mix, but they did. And a little while later, I saw her get out, and she walked into the car, into the ladies' room, and I was standing here just like I'm looking down this aisle, and I could see her, and I watched her, and she had turquoise shorts on. She had a nice, cutely packed rear end, pretty legs, and I'm watching her walk in, and I had an AA thought, but I didn't know it was an AA thought. I recognized it about 29 years later, because she's walking in, and I'm going, you know, I want what she has, and I'm willing to go to any length to get it. And I did. I had a chance encounter with her the next day. I had a buddy with me. She had a girlfriend. And I was sober and nervous, but she let me sit down, buy him a cup of coffee, told me her name was Barbara. And we started to date. And on February the 25th, 1963, her 20th birthday, she pinned these wings right up here, right here. Could have had a better day. Hollywood could not have scripted a better day. I had done it. I had made it. I had done well. I could relax. I could go home. She pinned one of my gold bars on me. My instructor pinned another gold bar on the other shoulder. I'm now a commissioned Marine Corps officer. Long way from that high school 18-year-old kid that started 4.5 years earlier. We went home to Wichita. She stayed with my sister. And as the leave was coming to an end, I called her and I said, "You're going back to California. I'm going to California. You're going home to Texas. Let's run down to Oklahoma and get married." So we ran down, stood in front of a Justice of the Peace, and we got married in front of a Justice of the Peace in Newkirk, Oklahoma. And this past March the 9th, she and I celebrated 52 years together. And I'll tell you, she's prettier now than she was when I married her. I'm such a romantic. Used to have to drink before I could say things like that. She joined me in California. She was the youngest wife in the Marine Squadron. She was instantly pregnant, which I thought was part of my Marine Corps duty. And we had a little baby boy, and 8 days, less than a year later, we had another one. People come up and go, "You guys Catholic?" I go, "No, we're just horny Protestants." And we headed for Vietnam. We were one of the first Marine jet squadrons to go to Vietnam. So I left Barbara in Texas with these two little babies and went to Vietnam. We went into a place called Chu Lai, Vietnam, 50 miles south of Da Nang. A typical Marine Corps operation, sand, tents, hot, no air conditioning, no ice cubes, no creature comforts, no nothing. A little portable landing strip that was half of what we needed. And we used jet assist takeoffs for our combat and operations and land carrier landing gear. We were all carrier qualified. And it was very primitive. And I was with 28 of the finest, most noble men I'll ever have an opportunity to be with. That's a once-in-a-lifetime experience, and I got to be right in the middle of them. We acquitted ourselves very well over there. I picked up a few decorations. I picked up a regular commission. I put in for it knowing full well the Marine Corps will never give a regular commission, which were very competitive at that time, to an officer who has only a high school diploma. You know, you needed college to get those things, and I got it. And that's what I'm supposed to do. That's what I expect of me. That's what others expect of me. That's what I've always been about. I'm not supposed to go into a bar in Fargo, North Dakota, and disgrace myself and become a national pariah, a joke, a laughingstock. Made Jay Leno's monologue for many, many, many nights. And he called me in June of 96 and apologized. That's another story. I'll tell you right now, you're going to hear about 30% of the whole story. And I'm going to try to get through this thing in a timely way. But you'll hear about 30% of it. It's a lot of stuff that I don't have time to talk about. I came back from Vietnam. Finally decided to get out of the Marine Corps because I was going to be gone from my family and these two little kids for 4 to 6 years overall before I could retire. It was a very painful decision because I loved it. I loved it. I just didn't want to get out, but I knew I had to for the sake of the family. 3 weeks later, I was in class at Northwest Airlines. And for nearly 22 years, I had the same kind of career. I loved going to work. Going to work was fun. I loved the people I flew with, both in the front and the back. One of my friends from the backside of us here tonight, I flew with him and his wife and got to fly with Val's husband, Cal, before he passed away. I couldn't wait to go to work. My alcoholism was picking up, but I'm still not where you can really pull me away from the crowd. Although my crowd is diminishing because I'm staying more with people that drink like I do. Barbara and I got to the airlines. She had wanted a little girl, and we talked about adopting a child even before we got married. So I said, let's either do it or quit talking about it. So we put in for an adoption, which was difficult because we already had the two biological boys, and we fought really hard for 14 months. We bring this little Chippewa Indian girl home to our house. She was 17 days old and was the most beautiful little girl I have ever seen. Barbara now had her daughter. We had the perfect family and the perfect neighborhood, the career, everything was perfect. And she couldn't walk past me. This little girl couldn't walk past me without me picking her up and looking at those little face and those pretty little eyes and saying, thank you for being my girl. She'd say, thanks for being my dad. And I thought everything was great. And when she was 17, she ran away from home. And I didn't see it coming. Barbara didn't see it coming. I don't know if I had not been drinking, if I would have seen. One of the things I had trouble with as far as this alcoholism thing was I wasn't a nightly drinker. Sometimes I would, sometimes I wouldn't. I rarely drank in the morning. Three times a year, 4th of July, Memorial Day, and Labor Day, I drank. And I knew alcoholics all drank in the mornings. So I knew that I was okay. And so I didn't have a set pattern, but I purposely, deliberately varied those patterns. I came up with several tests a couple of times when I thought maybe it was getting a little out of hand. I devised these tests predicated on complete, total, ignorant, zero knowledge of alcoholism, and I passed these tests. So I was convinced that all was well. I had put off being a captain for 2 years because I wanted to be there while Dawn finished up school and then went to college, I thought. And so she was coming up for graduation. I went to Chicago to take a special written test to be a captain. And on the afternoon that Barbara took me to the airport, Dawn and some of her friends came and got what she wanted and left a runaway note. And Barbara didn't see it until late at night, and Dawn didn't come in. And I called home the next day, and Barbara told me what had happened, and I panicked. I was just scared to death. My little girl was gone. She was the center of my universe. So I blurted out where to go, who to call, and where to look. And I got on that airplane, and 2 hours later, I was back in Atlanta from Chicago. And someplace on that flight, something happened, and I'm not aware of it. I do not remember anything changing. But it did, because when I got off the airplane, I hated her. I hated her with a level of intensity I didn't know I possessed. And I told Barbara, I don't care if she dies in the streets, she will never come back to my home. And I never want her name mentioned ever again in my presence. And the rest of the family were so well advised as well as and my friends. And I hated her. God, I hated her. And within 2 days, there was no evidence that she'd ever been in my home. Everything she'd ever owned was had gone to Goodwill. I went to the bank and I destroyed her adoption papers, and I went to an attorney and gave him $500 and disowned her. I tried to annul the adoption and I couldn't. And in the midst of this tornadic activity, in the way that's only insanely amusing, and in the way that only an alcoholic would do it, I looked at it and I go, you know, I don't think Barbara's handling this too well. She probably needs a therapist. So I reached in the Yellow Pages, and by the luck of the draw, I got a good therapist, and we saw him twice a month for almost 2 years. I didn't like talking about my doctor and my daughter. And one time he was trying to get me to engage in conversation about it. And I made a statement that I had never consciously formed ever in my mind that I'm aware of. And it flew out of my mouth and it absolutely painted a one sentence portrait of who I was. And I looked at him. I said, I'm going to tell you something, doctor. I would rather hate than hurt. He looked at me. He said, you survived a childhood doing that, and if you continue, it'll destroy you. And he was absolutely right. And I look back when I got in treatment, I thought, that's what I've always done. I've learned that as a man, I don't have to experience pain if I'm not vulnerable. I've learned that I don't experience pain if I get angry fast enough, because anger is a manly feeling. Pain is not. And when I get angry fast enough, that wall comes up, and there's no pain that can penetrate it. I'm just busy being angry. And that's what I always did. Barbara suffered for that. I said and did some cruel things to her during a couple of the arguments that we had, a few of the arguments we had. She was first on my amends list when I went back to try to straighten all that stuff out. But in treatment, I learned a lot of stuff. I'm listening. I'm there to listen. And somewhere in the first week of treatment, we walked into a group room, and for some reason I began to talk about my daughter, which was completely counterintuitive to me. And I didn't have that wall of pain, and I broke down and cried. I had never cried. I didn't cry at my parents' funerals. My sister sent me an email several years ago, and she said, I grew up with you. I didn't think anything would ever make you cry. And I sobbed that day in front of about 8 or 10 people. I felt so ashamed and naked and embarrassed. It's one of the most wonderful things that ever happened to me. One of the greatest breakthroughs. Hadn't got anything to do with how tough I am or how tough I'm not. And I said, let's put this family back together again. There were no visitors, no phone calls in this treatment center. That they got wind of this, and they said, that's an impossible breakthrough for you. We'll give you a day room. Barbara knew where Dawn was, and about a few days later, I walked in. The two doctors asked if they could please come watch. And a few days later, I walked in, and there were my two sons, Barbara, the two doctors off to the side. And I looked at my daughter, and I thought, God, she is so much smaller. I hadn't seen her in 2 years. so much smaller than what I remember. And I walked over and put my arms around her, told her how much I loved her instead of how much I hated her. And in her arms was 5-month-old granddaughter, and my daughter got married, and I didn't even know her last name. I wish I could report that all has been well since then, but Dawn has made many, many, many horrible, grim, bad life decisions, and her life is a mess. I'm sad, I'm brokenhearted, I'm disappointed, but you know what? I'm able to deal with that. AA tells me this is about me, and what I have to do is accept. I can't change anything, I accept it. I meant to tell you also that during the course of that 2 years, the alcohol quit working for me. And I would go on layovers, and all I wanted to do was change clothes, get to the nearest liquor store, and I knew where all of them were, and get back to the hotel with a quart of booze. I'd lock the door, turn the TV on. I wouldn't go to the door if a crew member knocked. I wouldn't answer the phone if they called, and I would drink. And I don't know how you folks do it, but when I drink, I don't like it straight, but I mix them really strong. And sometimes I got to gag a little bit to get that first one down. Sometimes it's a little, I choke a little bit getting that first one, but after that, I'm home free. And that bottle goes down really fast, but I couldn't get that float away, golden glow feeling that always was part of my drinking. That departed, and I never captured that again. Because when I drank, I just didn't want to care. I just didn't want to care. And I couldn't do that anymore. And when I drank from that point on, I might as well have been pouring gas on the fire that was down here, because up came the hatred, the bitterness, the self-pity, the martyrdom. This list of things I'd done for her over 17 years. Look what I'd done for her. Look how she repaid me. And by the time I got to the end of the bottle, I was emotionally wasted, exhausted, and tired. And the next night, in a different town, I would do the same thing again and again and again and again. But it never worked for me after that. I got into treatment, and I hoped that this 12-step stuff worked. I hoped that the big book was correct. I hoped that the promises came true. I didn't know. And I think that the only reason I come to the podium, the only reason any of us do, is to provide 3D living proof to the newcomers who are coming in here. Does this stuff really translate? Once I leave treatment and go out here on the streets and the sidewalks, does it work out there? What about I walk out of my AA meeting. Does it work out here when I'm outside the parking lot and I'm on my way home? Does this stuff really work? And I'm here to tell you it does. And that's the only reason I'm here. I got out of treatment. Well, let me back up a little bit. I told my family that the folks were having to come down. A week to the day that I went into treatment, I got a notice from Northwest Airlines. There were two TV sets. I wouldn't go near them, but people report. And Northwest had terminated me, as they should have. I'd lost all my FAA licenses as an emergency revocation. That was fair. They should have done that as well. I'd lost my medical certificate because of my alcoholism, so I'm stripped of everything. Aviation-wise, I'm stripped. Then suddenly they start coming and telling me about legal stuff. Nobody knew anything about legal stuff on the day of the arrest. None of the attorneys for the company or the Airline Pilots Association knew anything about legal stuff. Now here comes legal stuff. Every 2 to 3 days they're taking me out of the group. Minnesota's going to indict me. North Dakota's going to indict me. Minnesota's going to double the penalties. North Dakota's doubling the penalties. Their federal marshals are going to come out and take me out in handcuffs. Then they call me out for the last time, the sixth time. And there was a doctor there, and I went down to his office. He said, I have to tell you that a federal grand jury's just indicted you. You're looking at 15 years in federal prison, $250,000 fine, and an attorney's coming in Sunday wants $50,000. We went stone cold broke within 30 days, and I didn't have the money. I said, I can't do it. He said, I have to ask you if you're going to hurt yourself. I said, no. I went back to my room, and I do not remember falling or collapsing, but I do remember laying on the carpet with my head next to the carpet. I'm crying for the second time in treatment. I said, I can't do this anymore, God. Please help me. I don't have enough, even for one more time. Please help me. I remember sleeping that night. I had many fantastic, amazing experiences in treatment that I don't have time for. I got out of treatment, and I'm immediately in a 3-week, heavily publicized trial. We draw the toughest judge in the Minnesota Federal District. I never got a break anywhere along the way. At any point where there was a possibility that it could go one way or the other, it never, ever once went the way we hoped. I go up there. I'm in a very heavily publicized 3-week trial, but I've got an advantage over the other two guys because I'm an alcoholic. And I can go to AA meetings, and I do, after the day is done in court. And a criminal trial is indescribable, especially one that is highly publicized like mine was, where the prosecutor is up there telling the entire world that I'm a no-good piece of crap, always have been, always will be, and it's being reported, and it's in the tabloids, it's all over the TV. The late-night comics are having a good time with it. I never shared in there, and I was scared because at first they recognized me. And I just sat and listened to everything you folks had to say, and there was an energy in the room that I took to the courtroom the next day. And sometimes when things were really going bad in the courtroom, I would look across the audience, and Barbara would meet my eyes, and she'd mouth the words, "I love you." And I would just nod, and I'd be okay. We went through this trial. I had an amazing story with an attorney, and I don't have time to go into, and I said, "I'll be found guilty." I wanted to plead guilty, and he explained the reasons why that wasn't a good choice right now. And I said, "I'll be found guilty, and when I am, I'll be okay." And so I'm the captain. Everything comes to me first. The jury went out. The jury came right back in. I stand up, guilty. He flinched. I reached over and patted him. I said, "It's okay, Peter. It's all right." We left. We came back for the sentencing. Sentencing guidelines were in place at the time. 12 months to 18 months. I knew I was a captain, and things had already been engineered, so I knew I was going to get 18 months. And I had made some peace with that. I was in treatment with a federal judge, and he said, "There's some things you need to know about our system." He said, "The sentencing is a charade." He said, "There's a process. You'll come in, you'll talk, your attorney will talk. But once we come through that door, the sentence is set. We never change from the bench." Judges and attorneys across the country have said that is so. They have corroborated that, and there are reasons for it. A day and a half before sentencing, my attorney called and he said, "I've got some bad news." I thought, "Jesus, you always got bad news. I've never..." You never call and say, "I got some good news." He said, "The judge has just said he's going to depart upward from the sentencing guidelines." Judge had strong feelings about this case, and I saw them every day for 3 weeks, and he was entitled to those feelings. They were justified, and I didn't begrudge those to him. But he had his feelings about this. He said he can go all the way to 15 years now. And this is a serious man, this judge is. So I went in on the sentence. I told Barbara, I said, step one, I'm powerless. I'm powerless over what's getting ready to happen. It's about acceptance. And we go sit in the courtroom that morning, and he lectures about what's getting ready to occur and why. And I stand to speak before a sentence is pronounced. And I talked. I was so scared. I didn't know even as I stood up what I was going to say. My prayer had been, just let me get something out from the heart. I was grateful for my sobriety. I was grateful for the things that happened inside my family. I had always accepted responsibility for this event from day one. I had never tried to get out from underneath that. And I couldn't change anything that had happened, and I accepted it. To everyone's sheer dismay, he announced a sentence on me of 16 months. Rocked everyone. 2 months less under the guidelines. Later, he told my attorney I was going to sentence him to 4 years in federal prison until he said what he said, and I thought of him more as a human being and about his time in Vietnam, and I came down and settled on 16 months. I knew something impossible had happened that morning. A miracle had occurred. I didn't know what or how. There's another really neat story to that, but I don't have time to go into it. He also did something. I had given all my personal effects to Barbara. I said, "I think he'll have us led away in handcuffs for the TV cameras." He also surprised us. He said, "This is a very complex case." And he said, "I know appeals will be filed because this law was not written, designed for pilots. And I'll let you three men remain free until your appeals are exhausted." And the other two said they would do that. I said, "I will go to prison now." Because I learned in here that I deal with life on life's terms. Not mine. I could stay out for another year. I'm whistling in the dark the entire time, and it's another year of countdowns. I wanted no more countdowns. And I remembered some kind of a phrase. It came from Shakespeare someplace in an English class that said, "A coward dies 1,000 deaths, a brave man only one." And I wasn't going to die 1,000 more deaths. Later, when I said I would go to prison now, he told my attorney, he said, "No defendant before or since has ever done that." He said, I was lost for words. And I looked at my attorney and I said, "He wasn't lost very long." So on December the 5th of 1990, 34 years to the day that I had entered Marine boot camp, I checked into the Atlanta Federal Prison as inmate 04478-041. I don't tell prison stories from the podium. Audiences love those stories. They'll hang on to them for a long time, but it has nothing to do with my recovery. My recovery, however, has everything to do with how I dealt with prison, the people in it, the situations and the circumstances, and all of the encounters that I had there. You know, and in a first person story like this one, you hear a lot of I and me, a lot of I and me. It's never been about I or me. This has been about us, you and me. Everything that I did from the day after the arrest was predicated on what I learned in treatment in Alcoholics Anonymous. It was a 12-step treatment center, so it was just an extension of AA. It's all been about AA. It's all been about the steps, every one of the steps and how I use them and how they work. The best part of my story is that I don't get any credit for it because I had no control over anything that happened from the day of the arrest until the final miracle occurred. I served 424 days in the prison system, one day at a time, shorter when necessary. I said that one time, and a guy came up to me afterwards. He goes, 424 days. He goes, he said, that's nothing. He said, I was out there 18 years. I just looked at him, smiled, and said, well, I guess you win. It was a long time for me. The judge had put sanctions on me to make sure that on top of the FAA and everything else that it was virtually impossible I would ever fly again. A year after I got out of prison, and another story I don't have time to go into, another miracle, he lifted those sanctions. The FAA then said, if you want to fly again, you'll start right over from the bottom with a private license, which I had never had. I came out of the Marine Corps, immediately had a commercial ticket with an instrument rating. None of my pilot buddies thought it was possible to go back and literally from the ground up get four licenses back. And I didn't either momentarily, but I thought, how do I stay sober one day at a time? How about I go after the licenses one license at a time? 10.5 months later, I'd passed the writtens on all four licenses. No quickies, no shortcuts, no cut across, just hard, hard work. But there's a flying element that goes with that, and I couldn't do it. I was back working in the treatment center that had saved my life in the counseling department. I'm making $14,000 a year, and it was one of the best jobs I've ever had. But I can't. I'm just barely staying alive. There's no way out I can pay for the flying. I get a letter and a phone call from one of the Northwest pilots. He said, I've got a flight school that you didn't know about, and I want you to come up here and live with my family and go get your tickets back. So I went up to Minnesota. Checked in with the Minnesota Department of Corrections. I'm under 13 conditions of probation. And I was up there with that man and his family living with him for 44 days. Rained out 14 days, and I just never quit studying, never slowed down. The remaining 30 days, I flew 78 hours. That's a lot of flying. And I got four tickets back. I had two of them by 11:15 one morning, and I don't know if that's ever been done before. And when I'm not flying up there at night, I'm in an AA meeting because that's what's given me my life back. That's where I belong. That's where I live. That's where I go. I came back with four tickets. I had wonderful experiences up there. I came back with four tickets, and I thought, that's great, but I will never fly on American soil. Not ever. A month later, my licenses physically arrived in the mail, and within an hour, I got a phone call from the head of the pilot union at Northwest. A grievance had been automatically filed, but I never activated it because I never challenged my termination. I thought that was fair. He said, this is the best phone call I've ever made because he said 3 hours ago, John Dasburg, president and CEO of Northwest Airlines, made a personal decision to bring you back and put you in full flight status at Northwest. I sat there with tears streaming down my cheeks. I couldn't believe this was a level of courage that is so far beyond the word extraordinary. I don't know how to define it. I had so horribly shamed and disgraced and embarrassed my airline, and they're going to bring me back and let me fly. And then when I thought about it a little more, I thought, you know what he's doing? He's literally gambling his career on mine. Because if I go back there and relapse after all my publicity, prison, alcoholic, and I go back and do it a second time, the board of directors will boot him out of his position and they will kick him off of every board he sits on. Why would he take such a chance? And I had that discussion with him when I went back. And I told him, I said, frankly, I wouldn't have done it. I went back there, very emotional return to work agreement with a whole bunch of my friends and supporters. We were wonderfully supported all the way through this, pilots and flight attendants. Never to be a captain again. And I said, that's fine, I've been a captain. But now I'm going to be able to give Barbara at least some retirement. That had been a knife in my heart that I had taken her through Vietnam, through all this stuff, and that she got a zero at the end of the road. So I went back, and my goal was a total 200% dedication to John Dasburg. Never, ever regret bringing me back. And I gave it all I had. And I knew I did a good job. I already had a good reputation as an aviator. And I was the most highly visible pilot on the property. Northwest now had a program, and I was part of that for returning pilots. As I was speaking, coming up on my last year, speaking to United Airlines, I get a phone call late at night from the same pilot who's no longer head of the MEC, but he says, John Dasburg just changed your back-to-work agreement. When you come back, he wants you to check out in the left seat as a 747 captain. I went back there, and I laid there in the dark for a long time. Excuse me. And I felt like God was looking down, saying, you know, every time you think I've used up my miracles, I can show you one more. Because I didn't think anything could ever surpass my return to Northwest Airlines. And now I'm going to be a captain again. So I went back and I spent my final year at Northwest as a captain, fully restored, trusted, not because I'm anybody special, but because John Dasburg knew that I was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That and that alone was the reason for that. I retired honorably at the then mandatory retirement age of 60 in 1998. Within about 2 days of my retirement, I get a phone call from my attorney, who's now my friend. He said, Judge Rosenbaum has just called me. He's now chief judge in the Minnesota Federal District. He said, in 16 years on the federal bench, he has never supported a petition for pardon, but he'll support yours if you want to make the attempt. This is 8 years after the trial. He wrote an amazing 3-page affidavit that I have yet today been able to read through all the way to page 3 without getting tears in my eyes about what the man says about me who tried me, sentenced me, and sent me to prison. He has become one of my strongest supporters. I just had dinner with him last December, he and his wife, when I spoke to the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. That affidavit went in, a bunch of paperwork went in. And 2 years later, I came walking in, and there were 8 phone messages telling me I just received a presidential pardon. That's mega huge. Mega huge. If you're a felon, if you're a convicted federal felon, that's life-changing. That's better than the lottery. My second day in treatment, I was at an outside AA meeting. My head was down. My head was always down. It was a week before anybody knew the color of my eyes. And I heard him read the promises, and I perked up a little bit at that. And I thought, I wonder if there's something to that. Why do they do that? Is there any real substance to this? And I was listening. And then they got to the part that said, no matter how far down the scale we have gone, and I tuned it out. I tuned it out because I knew I was going too far down. I thought it might work for the person on my left or my right, but it was not going to work for me because this was too much and I was going too far. And I've had more miracles happen. I wish I could share them with you tonight, and I just don't have the time. I thank you for having me here tonight. I want to close with something that I heard Father Martin close with one time, and I've taken it from him, who in turn took it. He took it from a girl who had sent it to him on a card. I got to know him a little bit and go to his Ashley Treatment Center a number of times over there in Maryland. Excuse me. It just simply says this: I do not wish you joys without a sorrow, nor endless day without the healing dark, nor brilliant sun without the restful shadow, nor tides that never turn against your bark. I wish you strength and faith and love and wisdom and goods, gold enough to help some needy one. I wish you songs, but also blessed silence and God's sweet peace when every day is done. My Comanche name is Yetzet the Napa, but you know me as Lyle, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you for having me here tonight.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.